On January 1, 2009, Fidel Castro will celebrate a half century as the leader of Cuba. Political scientist and activist Carlos Moore witnessed many of the radical changes in Cuba firsthand over the course of his life. His memoir, Pichón, Race and Revolution in Castro's Cuba, is published by Lawrence Hill Books, and I'm very pleased it has brought him to the show today. Hello.
Hi. Thank you very much for having me with you.
What does Pichón mean in Spanish?
Pichón is the most derogatory word you can use in Cuba for a black person.
It's like the N-word in English?
No, it's worse, because it means that you're the son, the descendant of foreign blacks, and foreign blacks are known as foreign excrement. So Pichón means foreign black excrement.
Oh, boy. And your name gave it away right away. Moore is not a Spanish name.
That's right. That's right.
So your parents were Jamaicans.
Correct.
Was there a large Jamaican population in
Yes,
Cuba?
Yes, because you see, after 1912 in Cuba, a racial genocide was committed in Cuba against the black population in 1912. They killed thousands and thousands of black women and men and children. After the racial genocide of 1912, there was the labor force was lacking. So the American sugar mills, you know, there was no longer anyone to cut the cane because of the number of blacks who had been killed, who fled into the mountains to escape the genocide. So they decided, the American sugar mills and the Cuban government decided to allow the immigration of these foreign blacks to come and cut the cane, and they came from the West Indies and Haiti.
But it's interesting when you think of Cuban culture, Afro-Cuban music is so important to Cuban music. Santeria, it really affects a lot of the Cuban sensibility, and that comes out of Africa.
Correct.
This is not Jamaican at all. These are the descendants of the people who weren't killed?
That's right. Santeria is essentially West African.
Yoruba.
These are the West African Yoruba religions, but you don't only have Santeria in Cuba. In other words, the Santeria belongs to one particular religious strain. That's the one which we call Regla de Palo, which is the Yoruba, the Nago. But you have also from other parts of Africa, from Dahomey, and then you have Voodoo, which is very strong in the eastern provinces. And that's where the massacre, the genocide, essentially took place in the eastern part.
My guest is Carlos Moore. His book, Pichón, A Memoir, Race and Revolution in Castro's Cuba, is published by Lawrence Hill Books. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lope. What was the racial mix in Central Lugareño?
Right, Central Lugareño, that's where I was born. There, contrary to the rest of Cuba, blacks were a very small minority there. You had it's a sugar mill town, a small, backwards sugar mill town in the eastern part of Cuba. There, the majority of the population was white. Of about 2,000 people, perhaps one-third of the population was black.
So would people have called you Pichón there?
Oh, yes. I grew up, I was socialized, fighting that term.
So race was a more important line than class line?
Well, you see, both of them, in Latin America as a whole, race and class is so intertwined, so fused, that you cannot deal with class without dealing with race, and you cannot deal with race without dealing with class.
Was race something you discussed with your parents?
Well, yes, but my parents were very reluctant to even discuss that with us because it was a taboo question in Cuba. You couldn't raise the racial question in Cuba. It was taboo before the revolution, and it became even more taboo after the revolution.
But before the revolution, Batista was the dictator,
yes.
And he was of mixed race.
Yes, Batista was a light-skinned black person.
And he brought blacks into his government.
That was the first period and the second period. And that's a reason why the black population initially had supported Batista so much. But Batista became a dictator in the second period of rule, that from the 1950s onwards. He became very repressive because he was rejected overwhelmingly by the white Cuban WASP population. They said, we would not accept a negro mono, a black monkey, as a president. So they were attempting to overthrow him. And this is where Fidel Castro comes into play, because Fidel Castro comes from the big WASP family in Cuba, and they started calling him La Gran Esperanza Blanca, the Great White Hope. And they said, we need a Great White Hope to overthrow this black monkey.
Although Batista wooed whites, especially whites from the United States.
Yeah, Batista was very assimilated. Batista, you know, he married. Batista used to straighten his hair, lighten his skin. But even doing so, he was segregated in Cuba. Batista could not go to white restaurants.
Even when he was dictator?
Batista was the only dictator or president of a country in the 20th century who could not go into white clubs. They barred him 3 times. From entering the white clubs. His children were barred even from entering the white beaches. He could not enter the white societies, and there were restaurants in Cuba in which Batista could not enter.
And he couldn't just change the laws?
Well, Batista was very afraid of bucking the Cuban white elite to which Castro belonged, because this elite was so virulently anti-black that Batista spent most of his time wooing this elite, trying to ingratiate himself with this elite.
Were blacks in Cuba aware of the growing civil rights movement in this country?
Yes. In the 1950s, yes. And in fact, what we had associations, you had a black civil rights movement in Cuba. We started expanding in the 1950s. Remember, after the genocide of 1912, blacks could not organize separately. Black organizations were banned. But when Batista came into power, in that first period, Batista was in power twice. He came into power through a coup d'etat, the first time in 1933. And Batista was kicked out of power in the 1940s. But while he was in power in the 1930s, he broke the ban on these Cuban organizations. And for the first time, black organizations were allowed to exist again. So when Castro came into power, you had already 526 black organizations in Cuba.
You were 15 when your family decided to move to the United States. Now, they moved here not because Castro came to power.
No. They were running away from the Civil War. They almost killed a brother of mine. Batista's forces almost killed a brother of mine. And my father was terrified of the Civil War, so he ran to the United States.
Was your family political?
My family was not political because they de-emphasized politics. They were immigrants. And it was dangerous for immigrants to become involved in politics in Cuba because they would get deported. So they had the syndrome of the immigrant. Let's not get involved in labor unions. Let's not rock the boat. Let's be invisible.
So you wound up in an African-American ghetto in New York,
right,
Bed-Stuy, in Brooklyn.
That's correct.
Were you considered an outsider?
No, because I was, to tell you the truth, when I came to the United States immediately, I mean, Bedford Stuyvesant was full of gangs, black gangs. So, you know, I was considering joining one of these gangs, you know.
The bishops or the chaplains.
Yeah, they had all sorts of gangs. And there was the ones on my street were the Buccaneers. And, you know, they told me, hey, where are you from, nigga? And I said, you know, I'm from Cuba. You know, I explained to them that I was from Cuba. So once they saw that I was foreigner, you know, they were ready to integrate me into the gang. And black Americans were always very, very, very welcoming towards blacks who came from the outside. I never faced discrimination from black Americans. I never did.
But you did face discrimination here,
yes.
from white society.
Yes.
Was it different than the way it had been the way you'd been discriminated against in Cuba?
Well, you see, in Cuba, when they discriminate you, they deny that they are discriminating you. They would use racial epithets, and they would use racial terms. They would call you black excrement, but they would say that this is part of the normal discourse.
But they also would distinguish between shades of skin.
Correct. And that's the
darker was worse, and that's something that happened here as well.
Yes, but in Latin America, that's the norm. Here, the norm is to emphasize your origin, your genetic origin. But in Latin America, they emphasize phenotype. Your lips, your nose, the texture of your hair, and the color of your skin. In one family, you could have different races in Latin America. Something like, for instance, when they came to take the census, they would classify, because my father was light-skinned and wavy-haired, so they would classify him, you know, as a mulatto. Then I had a brother who was dark-skinned but had wavy hair. They would classify him as an Indian. And then my sister could be classified as something else, and then I, of course, only classified as a Negro.
This is like what happened in South Africa. It's really odd.
Yes, it's strange.
Because it all involves the same family. But what was your take when you heard that the Castro's revolution was succeeding?
Oh, not to me. I mean, for me, that was That was the greatest event that could take place. I was already a leftist. I had already joined. I had been here in the United States for 2-3 years. I had come here in 58. Castro took power exactly 1 year after, on the 1st of January of 1959. In fact, on the 1st of January, it will be 50 years. And I was here in Harlem already under the influence of the Black Civil Rights Movement, because Maya Angelou had met me in a bookstore in Harlem. I didn't know who she was, but she became interested in me, and she started taking me around and socializing me with various figures here. So I was integrated into the Black Civil Rights Movement, and I started knowing important people there.
And she's provided the foreword for your book.
Yes. Maya Angelou is like a mother to me.
You describe yourself, you say, by October 1960, I consider myself a Marxist, albeit a peculiar one.
Yes, because there was a problem always with Marxism. From the very beginning, I joined Marxism because I saw it as the solution to the race question. But I met, while I was going around with these Marxists here in New York, I met a Marxist, a black Marxist, and his name was Harold Cruz. He was a social critic. He had been to Cuba. And he gave me a vision of the problems of race. And he told me, listen, the problem of race is not going to be solved with Marxism. He told me, because this problem is not a problem which is simply of capitalism. That's the first time anyone has said that to me. I was 18. So I said, what you mean? Communism will solve the race. But he said, no, this is not true. He said, because if it would solve it, it would have solved it in Russia. And he says, the Jews have been persecuted for 2,000 years. He says, so racism is not recent.
And African students later complained when they went to University of Moscow of being discriminated against as well.
Correct. My brother who studied, he studied 15 years in the Soviet Union. I mean, he met such racism in the Soviet Union that it was incredible.
Another irony is that Fidel Castro, part of that white elite, had said that an end to racism was one of the goals of his revolution.
That's correct, and I believe that. So when he came to Harlem, and I met him in Harlem at the Hotel Teresa, I believe that Castro was, I mean, that he was bona fide, that he was, that this would be true. So I went back to Cuba, believing that this, went back to Cuba as a Marxist, as a leftist. I mean, I did not go back to Cuba because of anything else. It was because Cuba was Marxist that I went back.
When did you meet Malcolm X?
I met Malcolm when I was living here in the United States. I was did not become a friend of Malcolm when I was in the United States. I went to listen to him at the Armory. That was the first time in 1959, in the summer of 1959. But then I met him and started working with him just the year before he was killed in Europe.
But he was nothing like a Marxist.
No, Malcolm was not a Marxist. Malcolm, when he left the Nation of Islam, was examining all of the various revolutionary possibilities that were open to him. But Malcolm was never a Marxist. No, that's not true.
Carlos Moore's memoir, Pichón, Race and Revolution in Castro's Cuba, is published by Lawrence Hill Books. We will continue our conversation after we take a little break. My guest is Carlos Moore, an author of books in several languages. He was a senior lecturer at the Institute of International Relations of the University of the West Indies, Trinidad and Tobago, a visiting professor at Florida International University in Miami. He's an honorary research fellow at the UWI School for Graduate Studies and Research in Kingston, Jamaica. And he's living in Brazil these days. He's written a memoir called Pichón, a memoir, Race and Revolution in Castro's Cuba, with a foreword by Maya Angelou. It is published by Lawrence Hill Books. So you say you went to Cuba.
Yes.
In hopes of being part of this glorious revolution.
Yes, correct.
What happened?
Big deception.
Now, you'd also worked at the Congolese mission at the UN before you went, right?
Yeah, but that's voluntary. It was voluntary work because we had loved Lumumba so much. I mean, we were really in love with Lumumba, with what he was doing and wanted to do.
Did you see him as something similar to what Fidel Castro was?
Yes, to me he was Fidel Castro in Africa. So my great heroes were Lumumba and Fidel Castro.
And you came to the attention of the FBI when you were still a teenager.
Right. I mean, for the next three decades, I would. You know, I mean, their file on me is so huge.
And have you been able to access the file through the Freedom of Information Act?
Yes, correct. I had lawyers do that, and they fought until they got, and it was just amazing. Amazing. I mean, they have been tracking me since 19. The tracking started in 61, and it went up to the 1990s.
In an odd way, it's probably helpful if you're trying to write an autobiography, because you know exactly what you were doing on May 3rd, 1958.
It helped me a lot, Leonard. It helped me a lot because it gave me precise dates, you see, and it situated things I didn't remember.
But you must have also discovered that some people you thought you were friends were your friends were talking to the FBI about it.
Yes, that's right. A lot of people were planted, you know, in my who became friendly, women and men, and of course there were plants of the FBI and also plants of the Cuban intelligence.
Did they consider you really dangerous? You were just a kid who had become politically radical.
Well, you see, at that time the FBI was panicky about this whole connection between the civil rights movement in the U.S. and Cuba, because you had in Cuba three great big radical trends. It was the Elijah Muhammad movement, which was headed by Malcolm X. Then you had the trend, which was also radical, which was headed by Martin Luther King, but that was more or less along peaceful lines. But then you had a third trend, which was inclined to violence, and that was headed by Robert Williams. And they were saying, we must resist racism with violence. And he started arming people in the South. He started, you know, creating militias. So the FBI was very panicked. And any connection between Cuba and the civil rights movement and these various black movements, they were scared of.
And you worked with Robert Williams on Radio Free Dixie.
Right. I was the newscaster on Radio Free Dixie, and I was his interpreter while in Cuba.
So you went to Havana, and they said, well, we'll just connect you to Robert Williams?
No. I was connected to Robert Williams here, so in the States. So when I went back to Cuba, when I fled the U.S. and went back to Cuba, Robert Williams immediately told me, listen, we're setting up a radio station, you know, to incite a, you know, revolution of blacks in the United States. And I want you to work on the, to be the new newscaster.
And those programs were backed by the Cuban intelligence services.
That's correct. They were set up by the Cuban intelligence system. I mean, Fidel, this was a direct decision by Fidel to help Williams, you know, broadcast. And we were broadcasting to the U.S. and it covered all of the U.S. and Canada and parts of Canada, teaching people how to use cocktail Molotovs, how to make bombs, how to sabotage, which parts of buildings to sabotage, you know, that type of thing.
You weren't concerned that you were doing something that might lead to people dying?
Well, you see, at that time, you see, I was so radical, so involved and so impassioned with this thing about revolution. You know, you have to go back to the period. They had killed Lumumba. We were enraged. We felt impotent. So I had gone back to Cuba to do something about this.
So, and when did you start to doubt Fidel's claims that racism had been eliminated in Cuba?
When he started saying that racism didn't exist. And I was facing racism every day. And I saw other black people facing racism every day. And then Fidel Castro simply denounced the black clubs as racist, as black racist clubs, and the black associations. And then he banned them. In one swoop, he banned 526 black organizations.
So you thought, I'll just go to Fidel and tell him that this is a big mistake. There's racism in the country. We have to do something about it.
Yeah, because I believed in what I believe Fidel was sincere when he was saying there is no racism in Cuba. I believed he was sincere. So I said, listen, we need a discussion with him. If we sit down and talk to him and convince him, you know, this can be turned around. And well, that was naive. What I did was naive.
You confronted him on his motorcade.
Yes, no? It was naive. It was naive because the way I would say that was one of the most naive and most dangerous things I ever did.
What
in
did
my
you
life.
Say to him?
Well, you see, I ran across the street when I saw that the motorcade had stopped, and you know, Castro at that time was being targeted for assassination.
You could have been shot.
They were going to shoot me. It was Castro who stopped. He saw me running, and I was shouting, "Fidel, I must talk to you." And, you know, they said to me, the orderlies, the security said, stop, halt. And I continued running towards him. So Fidel, for some reason, made a gesture to them to saying, let him approach. So they came and they frisked me. They saw I had nothing on me. So Castro said, who are you? What do you want? And I knew that was the chance of my life. So I said to him, I have been looking for you for 6 months. We have been talking about the situation. And he said, who is we? I said, listen, there are a number of intellectuals, a number of people have been talking, would want to talk to you. We need a discussion with you about race in Cuba. He said, what do you mean about race in Cuba? And that's what I describe in the book. He looked at me very with a lot of hostility. And then I told him, it is not true that there is no racism in Cuba. And then that was bad. That was really bad.
Actually, people were discriminated against because of race, because of sexual identity, all sorts of things.
Yes.
But you write that Castro belonged to a strain of dictators different from the ones we usually think of as dictators.
Yes, because...
From Caligula to Mussolini to Hitler to Franco.
Yeah, you see, I don't agree with these people who say that Fidel Castro, you just have a fascist dictatorship in Cuba, like they say in Miami. I don't agree with this. I mean, this is a revolutionary process. Fidel Castro is a social reformer. Fidel Castro comes from the big WASP population in Cuba. He could have been one of two things. He could have maintained the system that they had before, or he could have overturned that system and do something else. I felt he was going to overthrow the system, do something else. He did overthrow the system, but he had a choice not to do any reforms, but he did the reforms. So Fidel is not simply any type of a dictator. Fidel is a dictator. Cuba is a dictatorship. But Cuba is a dictatorship which has transformed society in a way that it transformed the lives of people.
So in some ways, it's been positive. In many ways,
it's been negative. There is no doubt. I wouldn't say that it's more positive and more negative. I can't use that scale. I would say that society has been transformed and that the transformation that we wanted, we did not get. We got some of the transformation that we wanted. But the transformation on race, in other words, changing the pigmentation of power in Cuba, that we did not receive.
Well, you stuck it out for a while. You worked at the foreign ministry.
Yes.
How many black people were in the ministry?
Very few. When I was there, there might have been about half a dozen.
My guest is Carlos Moore. His book, Pichon, A Memoir, Race and Revolution in Castro's Cuba, is published by Lawrence Hill Books. So you decided to leave. You just got frustrated?
No, you see, after I met Fidel Castro and I in the streets, because that happened in the street, and he said, "You don't do that." You see,
you knew you were never going to get this chance to talk.
And
to
never.
Him in
that's
a
why.
Way.
That's why I exposed my life, because I knew that was the only chance I would have. So he said, "You don't do that anymore." He says, "You have something to say to me." He says, "Now you get that on paper and you bring it to my office." And I did. And I did. I went with two other people, revolutionaries, and we went to take to his office, and they finally presented us there, and Fidel Castro was there. He was in his office, and at one point they closed the door. We were seeing him, you know, issuing instructions, and they closed the door. And then about an hour after waiting, comes out Celia Sanchez, his right-hand person. This was the second most important person in Cuba. And she says, Castro, Fidel has said for me to give for you to give me the letter that you have brought. So I gave it to her. I mean, she was authority. And she opened the letter. She read it. And she looked at me and she says, I hope. And she looked at the others. She says, I hope you people know what you're doing. And she dismissed us. And she went back to see Fidel and give him the letter, tell him what it was about. The next day I was arrested. I was taken before the Minister of National Security. And that was the most feared man in Cuba. And that was a horror.
So you were afraid for your life, I'm sure.
No, I knew I was going to be executed. At the beginning, I didn't know. I thought, well, if they're taking me there, is because Fidel has asked for an investigation. So I went in the car thinking that this was going to be something that I was glad for this meeting. I said, well, they're taking me before the head of national security. They call him the Cuban barrier, Ramiro Valdez. So just his name made Cubans tremble. But I said, since I went to Fidel yesterday, and this happened in a matter of 48, 60, 72 hours, I met Fidel, I went to his office, and I'm taken to the Minister of National Security. So when I was there, I realized it was a war court. They had already two people who were with me, who I had taken to see Fidel, were trembling and crying and saying, we didn't know anything about what was in the letter. It was Moore who told us. And they dismissed them. They took them away. They arrested them. And then I was faced. It was horror. For 6 hours,
you were an
horror.
Enemy of the state.
Yes, they accused me.
So how did you wind up not being executed?
Because they told me I had to sign a confession. At the end, they gave me that possibility. And at first, I wasn't going to sign. For many hours, I held out. And then they kept changing interrogators. And then one of the interrogators came in, and he opened the door for me. Because first they wanted me to lie and say I was an agent of the CIA, I had worked for imperialism. And I said, no, this is not true. But I knew they were going to execute me. So I knew this would be remain in writing. So they were going to kill me. And then they would say, okay, this man has confessed to being... And this wasn't true. So they kept bringing up names, different names of people who I don't know who... some of them I didn't know who they were. And they wanted me to implicate other people because they were at that time the anti-homosexual drive was in force in Cuba. So some of the people who had met with us were blacks, artists who were homosexuals. So they wanted me to implicate these people. So my refusal to implicate them, my refusal to give names, my refusal to sign a confession saying I was an agent of imperialism, that I was sent from the United States to do this, which they call racial subversion, then they opened up a last, final, and they let me know this is the final possibility we're going to give you. You have to sign this confession. And they sent an interrogator, and he was totally different. He came in, he offered me cigarettes, and he told me, I understand your problem. He said, I know you're not a counter-revolutionary. He said, but I know what happened. He said, you lived in the United States, where there is racism. And you came back a year ago, and you believe that the racism you faced there, you're facing it here. You haven't made the transition. You haven't had the time to do it. He said, so listen. He says, I understand your situation. He said, just write that down. And I did. I said, there's no racism in Cuba. I thought there was racism. The racism I had lived in the imperialist America, I didn't have time to make the difference. And that was what saved me. And they sent me to a labor camp.
Eventually, you left. You wound up in an Egyptian jail and in France and in Nigeria. Unfortunately, we can't go over all of that. But often a target of Cuban intelligence. The FBI had followed you, and now the Cubans were following you as well?
Well, both of them were following me. Outside, the CIA was involved also. I mean, the CIA was then because of my involvement with Malcolm X. So the CIA was not only the FBI, but the CIA and the Cuban intelligence.
But you still feel that U.S. policy toward Cuba has been misguided?
Yes,
despite
absolutely.
All they did to
yes,
you?
Yes, yes. What they did to me is beside the point. This is the internal struggle with Cuba. But Cuba had a legitimate gripe with the United States. The United States has exercised an imperial policy of domination of Cuba since the beginning of the 20th century. And Castro came to change this. And I always supported that. I supported it throughout. I never denounced this. And I supported it. And I supported it up till today.
So are you still the target of Cuban intelligence, the FBI, and the CIA?
Well, I wouldn't think that I'm the target of the CIA. I would say that I'm still the target of Cuban intelligence, yes. And if you look at websites like Afro-Cuba Web, who happened to express a point of view which is very much similar to the official point of view in Cuba, you will find that they will post things regularly on me which says that I am an agent, that I work for the CIA, that I'm salaried by the CIA.
Well, I'm ready to believe you're not salaried by the CIA, but I'm pleased that you came on our show.
Thank you very much for giving me the
Moore,
occasion.
Carlos Moore, his memoir, Pichon, P-I-C-H-O-N, Race and Revolution in Castro's Cuba, published by Lawrence Hill Books. It's been a real pleasure talking with you
today.
Thank
you very much. It was a pleasure being here.
Most histories of the civil rights movement focus on the South. On tomorrow's show, how activists and organizations in the North shaped the movement. Also, the history of the Hemings family, before and after Thomas Jefferson's relationship with Sally Hemings, a look at the life of Le Corbusier, a key figure in the history of modernist architecture, plus one of today's leading architects, Daniel Libeskind. The Leonard Lopate Show is produced by Blakeney Schick, Sarah English, and Stephen Valentino. Melissa Egan is the executive producer, and we had help today from Tanya Mirza, Fran Jacobs, and Tess Hartman. Debbie Fountain was at the audio controls. I'm Leonard Lopate, your host. Thanks for listening. Thank you.